The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome back to the program today John Scalzi. He's got a new book out. It's called The Collapsing Empire. Hello, John.
Hi, how are you?
Very good, John. Is it okay if I just call you Scalzi?
You know, pretty much everybody does, even like my best friends from high school, so
yeah.
I would be fine with that.
Well, I read your Twitter feed, John, so I keep up with you a little bit. It's kind of hard, though, because you're on there all day long.
Yeah, my editor sends me notes about that sometimes.
Yeah, like, how come you're not working on your next book, John? You're on Twitter. Can you do both at the same time?
Right. To which I respond to him, how come you're on Twitter? And, of course, there's never a good response to that. So.
Well, they just need to send you someplace like Hawaii so you can get your work done.
Which, in fact, was the way that I finished this most recent book. I got all bollocksed up because I was following the election, and then we flew to Hawaii so I could take part in a convention. And because it's so far behind the rest of the United States and because it's so beautiful, I literally put the rest of the world out of my mind and wrote 25,000 words that I needed to write in order to finish the book on time. So in all seriousness, I thank the state of Hawaii and the convention that I went to for actually helping me finish the book.
Well, I did notice that your Twitter activity really dropped off last week, I guess because you were on vacation.
Right. I was on the Joko cruise, which is a cruise of nerds and nerd-adjacent folks, and we went all over the place. And it was really interesting because for someone who spends so much time online like I do, the getting away from it. The very first day, you basically go through shakes, you know, withdrawal. And then after that, it's like, why did I ever spend all that time online? I could have been doing so many other things in real life with real people. And then you come back and you turn on Twitter and right in your face again. So it's a vicious cycle, really.
John Scalzi joins us. His book is The Collapsing Empire, which we will talk about here in a moment. John, in my book, you're probably the best-known author living in Southwest Ohio, but we have some listeners out there who probably have never heard of you. Who are you?
Well, I write science fiction, which is probably why many of them haven't heard of me, because it's a genre. And I've been in Ohio now for about 16 years. I moved here in 2001, and basically all the books that I've written have been written from my home office here in Bradford, Ohio. So in many ways, I'm very happy to call myself an Ohio author, even though I've just been transplanted here for the last 16 years.
And Bradford's just a little bump on the road. Don't they call it a village? Has that been a good place for you to work?
It is a village. It's got about 1,800 people. I like to joke that a traffic jam here is three cars behind an Amish buggy. And I have to say, I grew up in Los Angeles, so it's quite a change from Bradford, Ohio. But one of the things that I actually do like about Bradford, the people are very nice. It's a very sort of restful area to do work in. And the thing is, these days especially, I travel so much. I'm in the middle of a book tour. So when I come back, it's really nice to literally, get away from everything. I mean, I'd sit here and I'd be able to go out into my front lawn and just look at my, agricultural fields to the south and to the west of me and just kind of take a deep breath and go, don't have to worry about the rest of the world for a little while.
Mm. Okay, the new book. I think, if my math is right, isn't this the first book in your new publishing deal, The Collapsing Empire?
Yes, it is. A couple of years ago, I signed a 10-year, 13-book contract with Tor Books, and this is indeed the very first book on that contract, which is exciting in some ways and sort of nervous making it on the others, because obviously for a contract of that length and magnitude, you sort of want to get out of the blocks as fast as you can.
All right, so you've imagined a new universe. Tell us about it.
Okay, well, the universe that I'm imagining doesn't have fast and light travel. Most of the time when you think about spaceships, they're going fast and light using warp drives to go from one place to the next. And this one, rather than doing that, they take advantage of a physical feature of the universe that's called the flow. And the best way to explain that to people who aren't up on science fiction is imagine this great river going through space that once you enter it, you can very rapidly move from one star system to another. And so this empire of human outposts has sprung up around the flow. Now, like a river, the flow can sort of jump its tracks and shift and change. And so one of the things that's happening in this book is that the flow, which, again, humanity has relied upon to travel from system to system, is about to collapse and go away. And so now the question becomes, how do the humans who have relied on this natural resource, basically, deal with the fact that it's going away and it's going to materially change the way that human civilization basically works and exists? Are they, in fact, going to survive it? So that's the basic outline of it. And then, of course, what you do when you have that sort of setup is then you put people in it and make them do interesting things. So that's the plan.
In case you're just tuning in, my guest is John Scalzi. His book is The Collapsing Empire. And John is out on book tour right now, and he's going to be in Dayton for a book signing tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at Books & Company in Beaver Creek. That's Monday evening, April 3rd. He'll return to Books & Company. And, John, I love the fact that in this book we have all these futuristic science fiction, space travel imaginings. And then we have almost a medieval dynastic vibe. We have this interdependency, which is really, it kind of reminded me of Tsarist Russia or something like that. We've got guilds. We've got all this medieval stuff. It's all about power, and it's all about the big lies that people tell each other.
Sure. Sure. And that's intentional. I mean, one, it's kind of fun to mix eras a little bit, and you get to do that in science fiction. But the other thing is that one of the things that I based this on was not really the future, but the past. I really wanted to get the idea of this being similar to the era of exploration that was in the, like, 1400s through the 1600s, where ships and countries were really dependent on things like ocean currents and wind as opposed to engines and so on and so forth, because the dynamic was very different from the dynamic that we have today. And because in that sort of scenario, things like dynastic families or empires or nobility jockeying for position really was a kind of life and death thing as opposed to the way it is today. It made for a kind of more fertile crossbreeding between, spaceships and social organizations, and gave me a little more to work with and a little more to play with than I might usually have. And so that was exciting for me to do, and trying to imagine what universe would arise with this set of, social constructs. And at the same time, one of the things that you're doing, all this world building, is remember that each of the people who is in it is still basically the same people as we always know. I mean, the humans have not really changed in about 40,000 years. We're still the same people as we always have been, which on one hand is great. It's why we can read the Odyssey or read Shakespeare and still get it. But at the same time, it's also kind of frustrating in the sense of you would think in a world where you have spaceships or technology that humans would advance in one way or another, but in fact they don't, and we are still, despite our technological advances, still stuck with ourselves.
Remarkable consistency in humans. You have your empress at one point state, quote, I'm continually confronted with the human tendency to ignore or deny facts until the last possible instant, and then for several days after that, too.
Mm-hmm.
I kept thinking about global warming when I was reading about the flow and statements like that. You love to throw in a little bit of editorial in your books.
Well, I think it's unavoidable. I mean, one of the things that I tell people is science fiction takes place in the future, or what we would imagine a future could be. But the fact of the matter is it's being written and it's being read today. And so a lot of the issues that are going to show up and work one way or another are going to reflect the times. I am a creature of my time. And before I was a novelist, I was, you know, a columnist for a newspaper. I wrote about political stuff all the time. Mm-hmm. I can't entirely divorce what's going on in the world around me from what I write. Now, I do try to be careful not to go too deep into it or make a one-to-one analogy between what's going on in my universe and what's going on in the real world, simply because when you are creating a different universe, you're creating different, you know, ground states or different foundations. And so to try to map it exactly, aside from just kind of being boring editorializing, basically means that you would have to mess with your story. That said, again, I can't ignore the fact that right now we are talking about the fact that the Earth is actually, for the first time in human history, basically a finite resource. There are 7.5 billion of us. There's going to be 10 billion of us in the next 100 years. We are having an effect on the planet, and it's not 100% guaranteed that we're all going to get out of this alive, so to speak, that we may actually be doing real damage to our planet. Now, to be clear, the planet's going to be fine without us. If we screw up, it'll reset in a million or 2 million years, and then it'll be the cockroach's turn or whatever. But we will be very sorry that we messed things up. Mm-hmm. So, yes, all that sort of stuff is part of the DNA of the book, simply because I'm alive in 2017, and these are the things that I'm thinking about.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. And at this very moment, giving voice to John Scalzi. His new novel is The Collapsing Empire. I just quoted your Empress character, Cardenia. Introduce our listeners to your main characters.
Well, the first one, as you noted, is Cardenia, and she is the emperor, or empero. It's a non-gender-specific emperor title, of the interdependency. Now, she wasn't supposed to be the emperor. Her older brother was, but then he passed away, and so she rather unexpectedly became the person who, you know, went on to become the head of the entire interdependency, which is the name of the empire. And she's very uncertain about it because she hadn't trained for this, and yet all this responsibility devolved onto her, so she's trying to deal with it as best she can. And one of the things that she has to deal with is the idea that there is this collapse of the flow that's going to happen. Now, she finds this out through the graces of Mars Claremont, who is a scientist who is assigned to a planet which is the furthest away from basically everything, and that's why it's called End. And he is told by his father, who is also a scientist, that he needs to present this information to the emperor so that she can make the decisions on how to do it or how to deal with it. And he is probably the least politically connected and least politically aware person in the book. He is a scientist. This is what he knows, and yet he gets thrown into these incredible circumstances. Now, the way he gets from End to Hub, which is where the emperor is through the graces of Kiva Lagos, who is a merchant who owns a spaceship, and she is probably my favorite character of the three because she is totally engaged in her own thing. She's possibly a little bit selfish, but she's also very canny and pragmatic, and she probably swears more than any other character I've ever written, which just amused the heck out of me. And, you know, while my wife was reading it as I was going along, and she's like, this is definitely my favorite character.
Is she your first reader?
My wife is definitely my first reader, and she does a very good job of it. She loves me enough not to be nice to me, which I mean, if I'm the writing is not up to snuff, if she feels like there's a problem with it, she immediately lets me know. And she does it because she realizes that there's no point in sparing my feelings, that this is my job and I have to do it well. So if something's not working, she'll be like, yep, that's not working. You need to fix it. And we've been married for 22 years now. And during the course of that time, of course, I've learned to trust her judgment. She's a really good first reader and a really good direct line thinker. So when she says something's not working, I pay attention.
That's really a good thing to be able to have her to give you open criticism.
Well, I think it's really important. I mean, and I also, I have to be clear, when I was a younger writer, in my particularly in my early and mid-20s, I wasn't very open to criticism. I was one of those people who believed that everything I wrote was gold. Mm. And then something happened, which is that I became an editor. I ran a humor area on the America Online site. And what happened was then I all of a sudden had to look at 1,000 submissions a month for this humor area, select the ones that were good, and work with the people who were almost there but not quite there with their pieces. And so I did that for a year. And then after that, I went back to my own writing and looked at it. And for the first time, really, I could look at it with this critical eye, kind of a detached eye that I didn't have before because my ego was in the way of like, yes, I'm a brilliant writer. And then I would look at it after having been an editor going, yeah, no, you're not actually that brilliant. This needs a lot of work. And that was incredibly helpful, not only in the sense of giving me the skills to address my work, but also helping me get my ego out of the way. I mean, I have a huge ego. A lot of writers do. You know, mixed in with the usual bundle of neuroses and uncertainties and everything else. But quite frankly, the ego is there. So being able to have developed those editing skills that gave me the sort of distance I could separate the writing from who I was as an individual really made a difference in the quality of my work. So, but that is one of the reasons that I'm open to criticism, is because I realized at a thankfully early age, before I did become a novelist, that I, like basically any writer, needed all the help I could get.
Well, I think the fact that you're willing to admit that you look in the mirror and you say, I have a huge ego, I think that's good, because I think there's people around, and we won't name any names, who have huge egos and they don't see that.
Well, I think what happens is, that ego, there's a inverse relationship very often between ego and self-awareness. Mm-hmm. And speaking as someone whose ego got in the way of his self-awareness, if there's not some sort of intervening factor, it's very easy just to allow your ego to make you believe that everything you do is correct and everything you do is right and that nothing that you do is open to criticism. Now, for me, I had the two things happen. One, like I said, I became the editor. And the second thing is that I had a spouse, a trusted person who I loved, who was not willing to put up with, you know, my crap. It was like, no, I love you too much to let you wander around clueless in the world.
Uh-huh.
So those two things really helped. But if you don't have those, if you don't have a equal partner, if you don't have outside force that, you know, it helps to intervene with this, and if you are situated in the world such that self-examination is not anything that you ever really have to do, then of course you're going to go through the life basically self-aware, thinking everything is great.
Mm.
And, you know, people will suffer for that.
You have a device in the novel that you call the memory room. I love this device. Tell us about that without spoiling it, of course.
Right. Well, the idea of the memory room is that the emperor is able to go into the memory room and essentially access the memories of all of the previous emperors, so basically all her ancestors, her father, grandmother, all of those people. She can just kind of come in and ask them questions and get answers from them. And I like the idea of one thing to, look at somebody's notes or a memoir or something and read those, but know that those, again, going back to a theme that we hit earlier, are being filtered through ego, and they're not always going to be perfectly honest. Whereas in the memory room, all the information and all the memory is presented without ego. So when you get that information from the memory room, it's the unvarnished truth. And the unvarnished truth is sometimes surprising and sometimes depressing and sometimes exhilarating to find out, you know, something that you've always suspected. You find out, I knew it. I knew this was the way that it was actually happening. So I really like it as a concept, too. And I think in future books in the series, because this is meant to be the first book of the series, that's going to be developed a little bit further. One of the nice things about my particular writing process is that I write to find out what I'm writing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a basic idea of where I'm going and what's going to happen, but a lot gets revealed just by sitting down and typing. So a lot of the times I won't know exactly where a story's going until I start putting the words onto the computer screen. So we will find out basically about halfway through the next book whether it's going to be a two-book or a three-book series.
All right. John Scalzi joins us. His novel is The Collapsing Empire. I love your sense of humor, and we see that constantly on Twitter, but in all your books you have this wonderful sense of humor. And I think my favorite quote in this one comes out of the memory room, and the quote is, "I worked in marketing before I was a prophet." I love that.
I myself worked in marketing before I became a novelist. And so one of the things that you spend a lot of time doing when you are working in marketing is finding the levers to move people, to get them to do the things that you want or to persuade them that you know what you're talking about when you might not necessarily know exactly what it is that you're doing. So for me, without giving too much away with the book, the idea that at some critical junctures, people with a really canny idea of what makes people motivated and what will make them go along with you and your plans had to be important. And to some sense, we can have – it's actually a relevant conversation right now, which is what is more important, marketing or truth? Mm. Truth is sometimes messy. Truth is sometimes unhappy. Truth is sometimes will tell you things you don't want to hear. But marketing will sell you an idea or a concept, and maybe that idea or concept is not fully formed, but you're like, I'm going to go ahead with this anyway because I like where this potentially could go. And so there's a lot more of risk to believing marketing as opposed to believing truth. And again, it was not something that I intentionally put in there as a commentary for what's going on in the world today. But certainly if you are of a mind to see parallels there, they're going to be there.
John Scalzi joins us. John, at the end of The Collapsing Empire, in your acknowledgments, which are dated October 5th, you're talking about how you've been so distracted by the 2016 presidential election. And of course, mm-hmm. you wrote that right before the final results came in. Things have really changed since then, haven't they?
They sure have. I will be the first to admit I would have probably chosen a different course. But for someone who works creatively, one of the things that people like to say in times of turmoil is, oh, well, you know, the good news is that the art that's going to come out of this time of turmoil is going to be great. Mm. Which, for people who are actually creative people, is kind of an annoying statement. because it's not a conducive, creative environment when you're worried about healthcare. It's not a creative, conducive environment for creativity when you're worried about your friends. It's not a creatively conducive environment when you worry things about whether somebody you know is going to be the target of a bigot, so on and so forth. All of these things make it difficult. What comes out of that sometimes is art that is fueled by rage or resistance or whatever. But I, one of the things that I tell people is I would have been perfectly happy to try the alternate route and see what sort of art we got out of that. Be that as it may, this is the world that we live in now. And to some extent, as much as I or other people would have wished that it had gone the other direction on Election Day, we do live in interesting times, and that is going to have an effect on what we do creatively. It is going to have an effect on how we respond to the world. It is going to have an effect on how we get our work done. One of the things I wrote in the aftermath of the election was a 10-point step or 10-step guide for creative people to keep focus, because every day when you wake up and there's something else that's going on in the world and your brain just sort of seizes up, you have to find a way to make creative space. Otherwise, you're not going to get your work done. I mean, I have to deal with that on a daily basis. It's like I make a rule that when I'm writing, no Twitter, no internet, no outside world before noon or before I write 2,000 words, because that's my usual word rate per day. If I can get that done, then I can plunge into the world and do whatever I want on Twitter or social media. But I have to put that work first, not only because I have that ridiculously long contract, but also just for my own peace of mind.
You reward yourself. Well,
well, it's one of those. It's less of a war and more of a daily reminder that sometimes structure saves us. That particularly for creative people, but I think anybody, it's so easy to get involved not only with the world, but just things that are going on in your life on a day-to-day basis. It wouldn't matter in some sense what the electoral situation would have been. There's always an opportunity for creative people to be distracted by their circumstances. I mean, and sometimes in negative ways, but also sometimes in positive ways. I'm in the middle of this five-week book tour, and this book tour, it's very difficult for me to write because I'm always traveling. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm doing other projects as well as my writing projects. It's an attractive situation to be in, where it's like you have your choice of all these things you could do, and you want to do them all, but you realize there's literally not enough time in the day to do them. So the structure is both is going to save you positively regardless of the circumstances, because you say, this is the time that I put away so that I can be creative and I can produce. And then I have time for the rest of the world. It's super important for me to be able to say to the rest of the world, I love you, rest of the world, but you have to go away for a while because I have to create my own world now.
Thanks for sharing some of your time with us today, John.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to The Book Nook. My guest has been John Scalzi. He'll be rolling out The Collapsing Empire tomorrow night at Books & Company, 7 o'clock in Dayton. That's Books & Company in Beaver Creek, Monday, April 3rd. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.